Welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast, where we cover the latest news, research, and analysis of China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm your co-host, Juliet Liu. I am the loyal sidekick of Eric Maestrino, who is headed off this weekend to DC and is very devastated to be missing our recording today. Before we get started, I just want to remind you all to check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Eric regularly and I occasionally post all the news that we get fascinated by about the Belt and Road. And just follow us on at Belt and Road Pod. So today we're going to be talking about China's rise and what it's meant for the rest of the world, specifically through institutions that govern global trade. When trying to understand the implications of China's rise, the question is often posed, will China play by the current rules of the game or will it make its own rules? We hear this recurringly throughout our episodes and also throughout broader discussion about the Belt and Road. People ask, will Chinese companies be norm takers or new norm makers as they increasingly engage abroad? The World Trade Organization, or the WTO as we'll shorten it today, is the ultimate battleground for rulemaking when it comes to the global economy and trade. The WTO regulates and facilitates international trade between nations by setting a framework for trade negotiations, by working to reduce barriers to trade like quotas, tariffs, etc., and by acting as an arbiter to trade disputes between countries when needed. China joining the WTO in 2001 was heralded as a watershed moment in terms of China's political and economic integration into the world. It was expected at that point that it would herald the integration of China into the existing U.S.-dominated world order. But things have not been so simple, as our interviewee today is going to explain. Today, we'll be chatting with Kristen Hopewell, an expert on China and the World Trade Organization. Dr. Hopewell is a Canada Research Chair in Global Policy in the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia. She specializes in international trade, global governance, and industrial policy and development, and focuses on emerging powers, including China. Kristen's written two really awesome books. One is The Clash of Powers, U.S.-China Rivalry in Global Trade Governance, which just came out last year in 2020. And she also authored the book Breaking the WTO, How Emerging Powers Disrupted the Neoliberal Project, which came out in 2016. So Kristen, welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you. So to kick off our discussion, I want to start off by talking about agricultural trade, because this is something that you focus a lot on. And one of the quotes from one of your recent articles in the Journal of Peasant Studies is, you say that agriculture is an area of critical importance for developing countries, but it's also one of the most contentious areas in the trade system. So why is the agricultural sector any different from any other type of sector? And why is it contentious in the context of the WTO and other aspects of institutional governance?
So first of all, agriculture is extremely important to employment, livelihoods, and food security across much of the developing world. Over 2.5 billion people around the world, nearly a third of the world's population, depend on agriculture for their livelihoods. And many developing countries depend on agriculture as a key source of exports and foreign exchange earnings. And at the same time, of course, food is not just a commodity like any other. It's not just a widget, but it's essential for human survival. So how we govern agriculture and food and trade in agriculture and food has huge consequences. And so that's a key part of why it's been so contentious. Right. Another part is that countries like the US, the EU, other rich countries have very powerful agriculture lobbies that have worked hard over many decades to try to protect their agricultural sectors through things like subsidies and tariffs and other forms of trade barriers. So what this means is that developing countries have been forced to compete with very heavily subsidized agricultural exports from the US and Europe and other rich countries. And the agricultural subsidies that those richer countries provide give their farmers an unfair competitive advantage in global markets. And they also drive down global prices, lowering the incomes of poor farmers in the developing world. So these rich country subsidies have really been seen as a symbol of the injustice of the trading system, the way that it's been sort of unbalanced, tilted in favor of the rich countries at the expense of the developing world. And trying to create stronger trade rules to rein in and discipline rich country subsidies has really been seen as crucial to the interests of the developing world.
Great. Yeah. And it's so interesting because when I think of kind of the face-off between developed countries and developing world countries, and especially between the US and China. I usually think of sectors like tech or things like that, where newer problems of IP have come up, or other tensions about technology sharing. But this fight over agriculture is old. And in your article, you make the point that it's been decades in the making. And the opening of the article talks about the history of the WTO and governance of global agricultural trade. Especially, you kind of paint the story of a shift that happened from the WTO being an institution that privileged the interests of northern farmers and agribusinesses, as you were kind of just explaining already. And then it shifts to kind of a moment when a multiple emerging market countries kind of confront the developed world and cause a shift in how the WTO protected those northern farmers. Can you explain to us that history and what were the major points in that timeline for us?
Sure. Yeah, we've seen a major shift in power at the WTO over the past 20 years or so. Historically, the WTO, the trading system, was really dominated by the US, other advanced industrialized states. And those countries really, they had all the power within the WTO, and they were able to use their power to structure the rules to serve their own interests. They really rigged the rules in their own favor, while developing countries and their interests were marginalized. And in fact, developing countries were often subject to considerable economic coercion, arm twisting to try to compel them to participate in trade agreements that were really against their interests. But we saw all of this change over the course of the Doha round of trade negotiations that began in 2001. And in the early stage of the Doha round, three emerging powers, Brazil, India, and China, allied together, and they formed large, powerful developing world coalitions to try to counterbalance the power of the US and the EU and the other rich countries. And what the emerging powers did with these coalitions is they really turned the tables. And historically, in the trading system, developing countries had always been on the defensive. They'd always faced pressure to open and liberalize their markets, to reduce trade barriers. And what the emerging powers did is they formed these developing world coalitions, and they went on the offensive against the US and EU and other rich countries. And they specifically demanded that the rich countries reduce their agriculture subsidies, because this was such a critical issue for the global South, and also seen as a real sign of the hypocrisy of the rich countries. Mm. So through mobilizing these developing world coalitions, the emerging powers brought an end to that longstanding dominance of the rich countries in the WTO. And these coalitions also catapulted Brazil, India, and China into the inner circle of power within the institution. So the Doha round of trade negotiations became transformed into this north-south struggle between developed and developing countries. And ultimately, the Doha round ended in a collapse. The two sides in that struggle weren't able to reach an agreement. There was an impasse in the negotiations, and the round collapsed. But since the end of the Doha round, negotiations have continued at the WTO, and that same north-south dynamic, that north-south struggle, has continued to shape negotiations at the global level.
That's fascinating, this kind of break that happened in 2001, which is right when China joined. So you kind of, you describe two cases. You know, oftentimes we think of China as being the main challenge to the US and EU dominance in institutions like this. But you start off the story with Brazilian investment in cotton and sugar and the ways that it challenged EU dominance in sugar and US cotton subsidies. Tell us a little bit about that Brazilian challenge that kind of was a watershed moment.
Yeah, so this was a critical event in the WTO. In the early 2000s, Brazil launched two major trade disputes at the WTO, one challenging U.S. cotton subsidies and the second challenging EU sugar export subsidies. And Brazil went on to win both of these cases, and they were really seen as a landmark victory for developing countries. They marked the first time that developing countries had used the WTO dispute settlement system to challenge the agriculture subsidies provided by the rich countries. So this was seen as a watershed moment, finally developing countries using the trading system to actually advance their own interests. And Brazil was really presented as a hero of the developing world and its poor farmers, taking on the US, the EU, and the other big powers at the WTO. And Brazil really used that to increase its power and its influence at the WTO. This image of it as a hero of the developing world really added moral weight to what it was trying to accomplish within the institution. In reality, though, Brazil's taking these two cases was really driven by the interests of its agribusiness sector. Brazil is now one of the world's biggest agricultural exporters and a real challenger to the traditional two biggest agricultural exporters, the US and EU. So in the end, as a result of these cases, the EU was forced to eliminate its export subsidies for sugar. And the US case, the resolution of the case dragged on for many years, for over a decade, as the US really resisted reforming its cotton subsidies. Ultimately, it settled the case with Brazil in 2014, and it paid Brazil $750 million in compensation. And it also reached a side deal with Brazil worth nearly $1 billion, where the US agreed to open up its beef market to Brazil's Oh, wow. exports. Yeah, so Brazil reaped big gains for its agribusiness sector as a result of this cotton case. But in the end, the rest of the developing world, other developing countries were cotton producers, such as the West African cotton producing countries, who have some of the world's poorest cotton farmers. They were really left out in the cold. Right. They were left stranded, and they wound up the big losers. The U.S. maintained most of its cotton subsidies, made only minimal reform to its cotton programs. So at the end of the day, it was those poor West African cotton farmers who really were left stranded by the results of this case.
Right. Just to point out parallels, we interviewed Gustavo Oliveira, who studies Brazilian soy. And one of the points that he made in terms of Chinese investment in Brazil was that the extremely powerful agribusiness companies in Brazil were very successful at pitching a very like xenophobic approach to pushing back on Chinese investments in Brazil in the soy industry in ways that were pretty self-serving. And you have this number in your paper that says that agribusiness accounts for 75% of Brazil's agricultural production and virtually all of its exports. So the power of agribusiness in Brazil, I think, can't be overstated. They were the ones, they were the big winners in that dispute. And then there were a number of losers on the other hand.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so tell us then again about the next case, which is also fascinating, this case of Indian food stock holding. A lot of what you write about for listeners who are interested in looking up some of Kristen's other work, you do a great job of breaking down the problems of subsidies like the US cotton subsidies, the EU sugar export subsidies. You also talk in this really interesting case about Indian food stock holding. Explain to us what food stockholding does and how India used that as a way of kind of protecting their own interests.
Sure. So over the last decade, India has implemented a large-scale food stockholding program where essentially the Indian government buys food from farmers and then distributes that food to poor consumers at subsidized below-market prices. That's no problem under the rules of the WTO. Countries are allowed to subsidize food for consumers. The issue, though, is that if a government buys food from farmers at subsidized rates, at above market prices, that constitutes a subsidy and potentially puts the country in danger of breaching its WTO subsidy limits. So many developing countries have become interested in creating these types of food stockholding programs to try to support their farmers and also boost food security since the 2008 global food crisis, where there was a sharp price spike and also a supply crunch in food. And that generated a lot of interest in what types of programs governments could use to try to improve food security. So India has this massive food stockholding program that put it in danger of potentially running afoul of its WTO subsidy limits. So India waged a campaign at the WTO to try to secure an exemption from WTO subsidy rules for food stockholding programs. And here too, like Brazil, it really portrayed itself as a crusader working on behalf of poor farmers and trying to support food security. And India was ultimately successful. It secured an exemption, but only for existing food stockholding programs like its own. And so that left the majority of developing countries who don't actually have these types of programs in play yet out in the cold. And the other issue is that India exports from its stocks. So that means that India is flooding markets in other developing countries with cheap grain exports, hurting farmers and the agriculture sectors in those developing countries, primarily in other parts of Asia as well as in East Africa. So other states have been working at the WTO to try to tighten the rules to prevent countries like India from doing this, exporting from their stocks. But India has dug in its heels and refused, blocking those efforts. So here, too, it's another example of how these emerging powers have been presenting themselves as heroes of the developing world. And they've been using that to gain support for their cause of advancing their objectives and their interests at the WTO. But in the end, they've really been pursuing their own narrow interests, oftentimes at the expense of other developing countries.
Right. Right. So then you bring in this China case, which is really fascinating because China is doing the same thing, presenting itself as a hero of the developing world at the WTO. And then you bring up the case of China's cotton subsidies. So first, I had also read your piece in the Washington Post a couple years back, and you kind of break down China's use of agricultural subsidies in the first place. Tell us a little bit about why, because a lot of countries used agricultural subsidies. Why is it really important to China to protect its own farmers and to subsidize the agricultural sector?
Sure. Well, first of all, this is entirely new. You know, it's only very recently that China started subsidizing its farmers. In the past, subsidies were really something just provided by rich countries. They were the ones who had the resources to support their farm sectors. But as emerging economies like China have grown richer, they've become bigger subsidizers of agriculture. And China today is now actually the world's biggest agricultural subsidizer. So that's a real shift that we've seen. Traditionally, it was just the rich countries providing agriculture subsidies, but now these big emerging economies are also big subsidizers. Mm-hmm. And the issue is that their subsidies, just like the subsidies provided by the US or the EU, have potentially very harmful effects for poor farmers elsewhere in the developing world. So China says its subsidies are motivated by the desire to foster rural development. China faces high levels of rural poverty and also a big rural-urban income divide where income levels are much lower in rural parts of the country than in urban areas. And that's something that the government is trying hard to address. So China claims that its subsidies are driven by this desire to address rural poverty and help foster rural development. But one of the problems with that is that China's been rapidly modernizing its agriculture sector. And part of what that's meant is increasing concentration in the ag sector and the rise of agribusiness. So as a result, most of the benefits of China's agriculture subsidies are actually going to agribusiness now, not to small farmers. And the second issue is that even though China is a developing country, as I said, its subsidies still have harmful effects on poorer and weaker developing countries. So even though China's a developing country, per capita incomes in China are still about $10,000 a year. Whereas in the West African cotton producers, for instance, per capita incomes, average incomes are just about $900 a year. So there's this vast gulf that separates China from other developing countries. And China has far greater resources available at its disposal to support its farmers and support rural development. And there are other ways that China could support rural development without the harmful spillover effects that its current policies are having on farmers in other developing countries. Right. Mm-hmm. So, for example, China could provide direct income payments to its farmers that were delinked from production. That would benefit its farmers, help to raise their incomes, but it wouldn't artificially boost production and have the same trade distorting effects of its current policies. But the issue is that China's subsidies are not just about economic or development motives. They also have an important security angle to them as well. So China has a legacy of famine and food insecurity. And one of the things that it's very concerned about is with growing tension between China and the U.S., it's concerned that one day if there was ever a potential security conflict with the U.S., the U.S. could weaponize food trade and use its power to block imports of food into China, jeopardizing China's food security. So for that reason, China is really concerned with ensuring that it has domestic self-sufficiency in food, so it's not vulnerable to having its food supply cut off in the event of a conflict with the U.S. So that's a big reason why it's using subsidies, is to actually boost domestic agricultural production to ensure that food self-sufficiency. And then the second piece of the security angle is internal. Some of China's agriculture subsidies, for example, in cotton, most of China's cotton production takes place in Xinjiang. So that's where most of its cotton subsidies are directed. And there, most of China's cotton production is controlled by these quasi-military conglomerates. And China's cotton subsidies are really part of the government's effort to try to assert control over the region and suppress the Uyghur population in Xinjiang. So there's this complex nexus of economic and security motives behind China's agriculture subsidies that is part of what's made this issue so sticky and made China so resistant to efforts to try to reduce its subsidies. They're not just economic in nature, but they also have this security motive behind them as well.
Right. And you write at some point that the production of cotton in Xinjiang, it's far more resource intensive and less cost effective than if it were produced in most other places. But it's subsidized in this way, largely for territorial purposes, for purposes of keeping the area kind of stable.
Exactly. Yeah. So China and the U.S. are both amongst the world's least efficient cotton producers,
right.
But they're big cotton producers, and the U.S. is a big cotton exporter because of the subsidies that they provide. And in China's case, most of its cotton production is in Xinjiang. And, you know, that's the home of China's Muslim minority, the Uyghur population, which has now been subject to considerable suppression and repression by the Chinese government. And so China's cotton subsidies are part of this effort to assert control internally over the Xinjiang region and contribute to the pacification and the Sinicization of that region.
Right. So tell us a little bit about how then have Chinese subsidies come up in the context of the WTO, specifically the issue of China's cotton subsidies. How has that played out in WTO kind of conflict resolution?
Sure. So the big issue with China subsidies is just the volume and the scale at which it's providing these subsidies, which now just dwarf those of other countries. And the other issue is that China is such a big market that its policies have huge implications on global markets and global prices. So in cotton is a key export crop for some of the world's poorest countries, particularly cotton producers in West Africa, countries like Mali, Chad, Burkina Faso, and Benin. And in the past, the U.S. has been infamous for its cotton subsidies and for the harm that they've done to some of these very poor countries and their farmers. But what we've seen is over the past decade, China has actually come to surpass the U.S. to become the world's biggest cotton subsidizer. So over the past decade, China provided $41 billion in cotton subsidies, which is six times more than the subsidies that the U.S. provided. The U.S. provided just $7 billion in subsidies over that time. So the issue is now, in order to try to tackle the cotton problem, the problem caused by subsidies, it's really essential to tackle China's subsidies. And at the WTO, both the US and EU and other rich countries have indicated that they're willing to commit to reducing their subsidies at the WTO, but only if China agrees to reduce its subsidies as well. And the issue is that China has refused. So the negotiations on agriculture subsidies and on cotton subsidies specifically have both reached an impasse. States have been unable to agree on new subsidy disciplines, particularly because of this sticking point, China's subsidies.
Right. And I just want to point out actually for our listeners that Kristen's writing is about things that typically are like understanding WTO negotiations is very complex, but your work, I mean, you just have these incredible anecdotes and quotes from high-level negotiators that are at work in these institutions that bring so much life and color to the cases that you present. Just as a side note, it makes it a real pleasure to read and to see the kind of inner thinking of people that are working at these high levels of negotiation is really fascinating. But so, yeah, there was some quote by someone referring to it as a ping pong match between China and the US or kind of a stalemate between the two, basically.
Yeah, and I think the quote is something about how developing countries have really gotten caught in the middle of the struggle.
Right.
So the
right.
U.S. says, okay, we'll reduce our subsidies, but only if China does. And China says, no way, we're not going to reduce our subsidies. And there's this back and forth between these two major powers. And meanwhile, developing countries, the rest of the developing world, is just trapped between these two major powers who are refusing to budge. And it's ultimately developing countries who are hurt the most by this impasse.
Exactly. Yeah, it's fascinating. So, okay, I'm going to move into a different topic, which gets into your fascinating new book, which is just out. It was out in 2020. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. So we also recently interviewed someone, Jessica Liao, talked a little bit about this, but explain to us as a kind of a refresher, you look at export credit and export credit is incredibly important. There's one quote that you have in the book that export credit is like the fuel in the engine of global trade, I think is the explanation. So what is export credit and why does it matter so much for global trade?
So export credit is the use of loans and other forms of financing by states to promote their exports. And basically every major economy in the world has an export credit agency that provides export credit to try to facilitate and boost their exports. So in the US, for example, there's a US Export-Import Bank, and they provide loans, other forms of financing to various different sectors within the US to facilitate their exports. One example is the aircraft industry. So Exim provides loans to support the sale of Boeing jets to foreign buyers. Mm. So a single large commercial aircraft can cost hundreds of millions of dollars. So these are big ticket, expensive items. The purchasers rarely pay cash, but instead require financing in order to make the transaction possible. So an export credit agency like Exim can step in to provide that financing to facilitate those transactions. And aerospace is just one example of the types of industries that are supported through state-backed export credit. Typically, export credit is used to support big ticket items, things like major infrastructure projects, power plants, large-scale transportation equipment, those sorts of major purchases. And export credit from government is important because it can fill gaps in the availability of private sector financing. And that's often especially important in sales to emerging markets, where less developed capital markets often limit the availability of private commercial financing.
Right. So in other words, everything that the Belt and Road is doing, which in terms of China selling services and major kind of infrastructure to developing world countries, export credit becomes extremely important for that.
Exactly. Much of the financing for the Belt and Road Initiative is in the form of export credit. So it's loans that are tied to the export of Chinese goods and services.
Okay. And so my understanding is that the OECD countries, which is, the club of rich countries, it's often described as, they have certain restrictions and rules on the use of export credit. And China is not a member of the OECD, so it's kind of free of those rules. So in what ways has the OECD created rules around export credit to govern that part of the global economy?
Yeah, so the concern or the issue with export credit is that if it's not properly regulated at the global level, that it can be used as a form of export subsidy, a way for countries to artificially boost their exports. And the danger there is that that could spur a competitive spiral of state subsidization, where states are draining their national budgets, trying to compete with each other based on how much they can subsidize their exports. And so that, would effectively spur a global subsidy war based on export credit. So that's why states came together originally back in the 1970s at the OECD in order to create what's known as the OECD arrangement, a set of rules governing export credit. And those rules have been continually strengthened and updated since then to make them work more effectively and to basically give them more teeth, make them bite stronger in reducing export credit subsidies. So the OECD arrangement essentially sets the minimum interest rates and other minimum financing terms that states can offer to borrowers. And what it's been used to do is to prevent states from subsidizing export credit. And over the years, it's proven extremely effective in basically eliminating the subsidy component of export credit.
Right, making sure it's an even playing field across all the countries offering these.
Exactly, making sure it's a level playing field and states aren't using export credit to give their exports unfair or artificial competitive advantage. Right. So the issue, as you said, is that China is not a participant in the OECD arrangement. And China is now the world's biggest export credit supplier by far. China is providing vast sums of export credit, more than all of the other G7, that's the group of rich countries, more than all of the other G7 countries combined. And China's been using export credit as part of the BRI, as part of its other efforts to try to boost its exports, to expand its industry globally, and to give its industries a competitive edge in global markets. But the problem is that, the established system of rules governing export credit at the OECD risk becoming irrelevant if the world's biggest provider of export credit, China, is not actually a participant in those rules. And so there's a danger of the system of rules being eroded and ultimately plunging the world back into an export credit subsidy war.
Right. And how does this play into the question of cheap loans that China is giving, or of like high risk loans, or even the idea of a debt trap? Is this part of that conversation, or am I misunderstanding the function of export credit?
No, this is very much tied to the debate about China's cheap loans and debt diplomacy, debt trap diplomacy. In addition to setting sort of the minimum interest rates and financial terms that states can charge when they issue export credit, the OECD rules also establish rules and provisions on debt sustainability, also on things like environmental and social governance related to export credit. So there's this whole set of rules governing the loans that states are allowed to provide via export credit. And because China is not a participant in these rules, it's not bound by those rules on debt sustainability or, you know, ensuring that human rights are respected or environmental and social due diligence is applied to projects. So these are big concerns with a lot of China's lending. And if China were participating in the rules, arguably would significantly improve the quality of the lending that it's making to the developing world.
Right, which might be a win-win. But yeah, this is all, it's fascinating. And so the export credit is really key in the export of big infrastructural investments. And you talk specifically in your book about rail equipment exports and coal. And these are two things. I mean, the construction of railways and the construction of coal power plants are just kind of two of the big things that kind of symbolize, I think, the Belt and Road Initiative, even to people who aren't even that familiar with it. And so this becomes really important for the shape and the look of the Belt and Road Initiative. How has the kind of lack of controls on China's export credit affected those two sectors?
It's had a big impact on both sectors. So in rail, China's used its ability to provide cheap export credit to fuel a dramatic global expansion of its rail industry. China now dominates the global rail industry. And the cheap loans that it's been able to offer, particularly in emerging markets, has been a key factor enabling it to outcompete other countries who don't have access to subsidized export credit and enable its industry to really become the dominant player in that sector. On coal, China is by far the world's biggest supplier of export credit for overseas coal plants. And the big issue with coal, of course, is the environmental implications. Coal-fired power plants are one of the biggest contributors to greenhouse gas emissions and to climate change. And so at the OECD, there's been an effort to try to negotiate new rules to restrict the use of export credit for coal-fired power plants, part of an effort to reduce carbon emissions. But the issue is because China is not a participant in the OECD arrangement and its export credit rules, China isn't bound by these new restrictions on export credit for coal-fired power plants. And so while other countries are increasingly restricting their supply of coal power plants abroad, China's has been booming, really undermining efforts to combat climate change.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, this has been all really fascinating. And I think the bigger implications of what you talk about in terms of agricultural subsidies, in terms of export credit, and China's broader growing role in the rulemaking at an international scale. So tell us a little bit in conclusion, as China's rise definitely does, as you argue, change the rules of economic competition across the global economy, you know, you make the case first in your article and also I think in your book that this is not necessarily good for other developing countries. China's wins in the WTO are not necessarily helping out the rest of the development world. And it's also not necessarily good, you make the point in your book, for U.S. hegemony, which it's helping to break apart. Are we just getting more and more entrenched in the U.S.-China rivalry? Is China just becoming kind of at loggerheads with the U.S.? And is that just going to get worse and worse? Or do you think that there's some kind of hope for moving beyond that?
I think one of the key issues is the debate about China's trade policies has been so heavily dominated by the U.S. that, as you said earlier, there's been immense attention to China's industrial subsidies, to its other industrial policies, its efforts to foster sort of high-tech competition with the U.S. and other advanced industrialized states. But I think what we really need is more attention to the effect of China's policies, its trade and economic policies on other developing countries. So we've talked about the implications of its policies in agriculture. We also see something similar in the area of fisheries, where there too, China now has the world's biggest industrial fishing sector. It's heavily subsidized and contributing to the depletion of the world's oceans. And there too, fisheries like agriculture is a key issue for many developing countries who depend heavily on fish resources for food security and livelihoods and exports. Right. So I think we need a lot more attention. We need to move away from a conversation about China's trade policies that's dominated by the interests of the U.S. and other advanced industrialized states to look a lot more at the implications of China's policies for other developing countries. And ultimately, at the end of the day, both China and the U.S. need to take greater responsibility for the harm that their economic and trade policies cause to the world's poorest and most vulnerable countries.
Right.
And the other thing, too, is what we've seen over the past several years of the U.S.-China trade war is both countries increasingly weaponizing trade as an instrument of economic coercion. So we saw that under Trump, with the U.S. arbitrarily imposing tariffs, not just on China, but on all of the U.S.'s major trading partners. We saw the U.S. trying to use trade coercion to achieve other goals, like threatening Mexico with tariffs in order to try to influence immigration policy and immigration flows from Mexico. We also saw a similar use of coercion by China, where China's been using coercion to cut off exports from Australia in retaliation for criticism from Australia of its handling of COVID. China's also cut off exports and imprisoned two Canadians in retaliation for Canada's participation in the extradition of a Huawei executive to face fraud charges in the U.S. So China's been very much using trade as an instrument of coercion to try to overpower and bully weaker states. Right. So we're seeing something similar from both the U.S. And China, and that's something that's really problematic for the rest of the world. So ultimately, what we really need is stronger rules in the multilateral trading system to try to rein in those harmful policies, those coercive policies of powerful states, whether those states are the U.S. or China.
Really wonderfully said. And I just want to encourage our listeners to take a look at Kristen's book, her recent article, which we're going to link both to in our show notes. But really just the story that this refocus of our attention from the clash between the major powers to all the people that get caught in the middle, I think is a really valid and really important point of view. So thank you so much, Kristen. Do you have time to stick around for recommendations after this?
Sure.
Awesome. Okay. Let me just remind all of our listeners to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We are the Belt and Road Podcast. So just look for at Belt and Road Pod and you'll get tons of news updates, really great discussion starters. We really enjoy hearing from our listeners and we really enjoy keeping that discussion alive on social media. So join us on Twitter and Facebook. Kristen, what are you interested in recommending to our listeners?
So the Wilson Center in DC has just put out a fantastic collection of essays from leading scholars and other experts looking at the impact of China's rise, both in its region and globally, including a lot of attention to the BRI. And so this is a really interesting volume that's worth having a look at. It covers a diverse range of different areas with really interesting analysis. So this is titled Essays on the Rise of China and Its Implications. And it's edited by Abraham Denmark and Lucas Myers at the Wilson Center. And it's available on their website to download.
Awesome. That's a great recommendation. I should put out as a disclaimer that Kristen and I are both joining the Wilson Center as China Fellows this year, which is really exciting. So I have an old recommendation, which just I looked back up when I was reading through your materials. And there's just an article in the Pacific Review from 2013, which as I get old, I'm just like 2013 was, you know, last year, but it's not. But it's a great article. It's called Food in China's International Relations by Dao Jiongja and Hongzhou Zhang. And what I love in it is a story, a reminder of the number of ways in which China is really still focused on food security as a political imperative for the strength and legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. A lot of it is rooted in kind of memories of Cold War era tensions globally when China was cut off by other global powers from certain key resources. But it's just a reminder that so many of the economic issues that I think that Kristen, your work speaks to, especially China's use of subsidies. I mean, it is fascinating, you know, all major powers use subsidies, but China has this special form of paranoia around food security, I think, that I find incredibly fascinating because it has such far-reaching economic impacts, but it is so kind of psychologically embedded and historically embedded. So I liked that article. I looked at it again this week while I was going through your work. And yeah, that's my recommendation. So that should wrap it up. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us. Your work is fascinating, and it was great to get to break it down with you a bit.
Thanks very much for having me.